This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Jack Williams, professor of climate, people, and environment in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison, where we tape the show. Jack Williams, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you got interested in environmental stuff.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, I grew up in San Francisco, California, and I went to a school in Ohio at Oberlin College. And while I was there, I got turned on to geology. I was fascinated by the field trips. I loved going out and seeing rocks out these beautiful layers and upon layers out there in Ohio. And from that, went on to a graduate school in geology and started to look. Got very interested in these questions about how to pass climate changes drive past ecological changes. So doing a lot of work with lake sediments and fossil pollen records pulled out of lake sediments. And after that, did a postdoc at Santa Barbara and then came here and started a faculty position here at UW-Madison back in 2004.
And when you got to Oberlin, were you a bird watcher as a kid, or were you one of those people who was a Boy Scout, or, you know, were your parents interested in nature, or did it just kind of trip on you?
Yeah, it's great. It's a great question. My parents kind of dragged me out on nature hikes when I was a kid, and as a kid, I resisted. I was always resistant to the going out there. But they were big nature lovers. They were big birders, and you know, it kind of seeps into you after time. And
I didn't know they were bird watchers. I'm a bird watcher, so
yeah. Well, they I'm still picking them up. I've become more of a tree watcher myself. They stay in place. They're easier to find.
But the trees are, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm wanting to go see a hawk owl in the next couple of weeks before this winter is over. I've never seen one, so
that sounds super cool.
That would be an expedition, though.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, so I've really enjoyed the chance to be out. And for what I loved about geology was it gave me two things. It gave me an appreciation of deep time and how old the Earth is. And then it gave me a chance to sort of understand the world around me, that what it seemed like just rocks at a road cut all of a sudden had structure and meaning and history to it. And that's what I really got fascinated by and started to pursue as a career.
How old is the Earth?
Of 4.6 billion years, I can...
4.6 billion?
Billion, excuse me, 4.6 billion years. That's right.
All right. And it wasn't created in 7 days then?
The science is pretty sure on this one.
We can be sure of that, at least on this show. That's a relief. And I know you've had this focus on the Ice Age. Mm-hmm. And what lent you there? What sent you there? What attracted you to that?
Well, what got me interested in it was coming out of college, I was working on these long time scales, and I loved it, but it was hard to connect it to my human experience. And when I told my friends in college what I was doing, it was hard for them to appreciate the wonders of the Devonian 400 million years ago. And so as I was thinking about what I wanted to pursue for a career and study, I wanted to move to a time scale that included the human time scale, included human history, the last 10,000 years. And what's become so interesting to me about the last ice age and previous ice ages is that these become these natural systems where we can study past climate changes and look at how species and communities have responded to past climate changes. They've been truly profound, both in terms of the climate changes and how they've transformed ecological systems.
And so tell us about the ice age and the climate change that ended the ice age and how species evolved.
Right. Well, sure. Sitting here, in Madison 20,000 years ago, we would have been pretty cold. In fact, we would have been under ice at that point. Of course, as you know, the southern limit of the Great Laurentide Ice Sheet reached its southern end right here in Wisconsin. And so most of Wisconsin was under ice at the last ice age, and the southwest corner of it was ice-free. And so 20,000 years ago, you would have had mammoths and mastodons cruising around. You would have had larches.
That would have been cool.
That would have been very cool. I mean, we always wish we had a time machine. If I could pick one thing to invent, it would be a time machine to go back and see those landscapes with those animals cruising around at that time. But as you fast forward and between about 20,000 years ago and about 10,000 years ago is when those ice sheets started to melt back. That melting was triggered by changes in the Earth's orbit, changes in how much sunlight we received in the high latitudes, which led to a warming of the Earth, release of carbon dioxide from the world oceans. That led to rising temperatures and ultimately the melting back of these ice sheets. And so a 3 mile high ice sheet over most of North America melted away over a span of about 10,000 years, driven by these changes in temperature and rising CO2 levels. And ecologically, what we saw was plant species shifting their range northwards. Spruce today, we think of being in northern Wisconsin across most of Canada, of course. But 20,000 years ago, we would have been at the northern range limit of spruce today. That this, you know, spruce would have been mostly south of us, black spruce and white spruce and so forth, all the way down to northern Georgia and even northern Florida.
So the southern pines there.
And where southern pines are now, those southern pines would have been mostly down in the Florida Peninsula, presumably, and maybe some of the coastal lowlands. So, you know, the boreal ecosystem then would have been most of the southeastern U.S.
And the warming that happened at the end of the Ice Age, is that analogous to the warming that we're looking at right now? That is, was the temperature of the Earth going up by as much as 4 or 5 degrees in a 100-year span?
Yes, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. And that's an important question and distinction. So in ways that it is analogous is that the magnitude of warming is about 5 degrees between 20,000 years ago with that 3-mile-high ice sheet and the today was about a 5-degree warming. So 5 degrees had this massive effect upon the melting of ice sheets, shifts in species ranges, and so forth. But it's also important, and that rise in 5 degrees was also accompanied by about a 90 parts per million increase in carbon dioxide levels, from about 190 parts per million glacial times to 80 parts per million interglacial times, and now, of course, we're getting close to 400 parts per million.
Because we're adding carbon dioxide.
Because we are through our burning of fossil fuels, right, and through land clearance, we are adding additional carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And so now we as humans have perturbed the global carbon cycle, and we have taken what was sort of a 280 parts per million pre-industrial level, about 1750 AD, and we've now added about 120 ppm CO2 to that.
And that's the 350.org, Bill McKibben's group, is related to those numbers.
That's right. And so when you hear about 350.org or other organizations, one of the great challenges for our era is the stabilization, stabilizing carbon dioxide levels and other greenhouse gases level at some level in the atmosphere in order to help stabilize the climate system, because carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, along with methane and nitrous oxide, is also is leading to the trapping of infrared energy in the atmosphere. That leads to accumulation of heat at the Earth's surface, and that is leading to some of the rising temperatures we've been seeing and are projected to continue to keep seeing.
How do you react as a scientist to those who are global warming deniers?
I think it's unfortunate, and I think it really muddies the debate. It muddies the conversation, because at this point, the scientific evidence, I mean, it's very clear that temperatures are rising. That's unequivocal, and that was stated very clearly in the 2007 report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the evidence for human causation of recent rises in temperatures through burning of releases of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is also very strong. And, you know, since the 2007 report, which is the last major statement, the evidence has continued to accumulate. We've seen more melts on Greenland. We've seen continued loss of sea ice from the Arctic in the summer and fall months. The trends are continuing, and on an ecological side as well, we're seeing things such as earlier timing of events, such as spring flowering. Those are moving forward. Some species ranges are shifting northwards or upslope.
Bird migrations are faster.
Right, all consistent with these climate signals. And so one of the things I think we're really seeing now is moving from the signal detection in the global temperature records, which is a lot of the early efforts were, where global temperature is rising, and now we're seeing these various effects manifest in the global ice system, in the global biosphere, and now, of course, there's things like ocean acidification, and there's other sorts of effects that are becoming apparent.
I'm speaking with Jack Williams. He's a professor of climate, people, and the environment in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. We're talking about global warming from a scientific perspective. And I've been looking at some of your work, Jack Williams, on the web. And one of the concepts you have that I'd never come across is this concept of novel climates that we might, by the year 2010, be in a situation that there's no analogy in human history, at least in a million years, you're right. There hasn't been a climate like the climate we may very well see in the next nine decades.
Right.
So tell me about that. What do you mean by a novel climate, and what are the consequences or implications of that?
Right. Yeah, thanks. And to be clear, that was 2100 is what we were looking at as our time horizon, looking out the next 90 years.
Yeah.
And what we did was simply take the climate simulations from these global climate models that are driven by these different scenarios of greenhouse gas concentrations rising in the atmosphere over the next 90 years, and asked the question, if you look at the simulated climates for the 21st century, end of the 21st century, versus what we see now in the late 20th century, are there portions of climate space that open up that would exist in the future that don't exist today? And what our analysis showed, this is a 2007 paper that we wrote, was that there were portions of the world's climates that moved outside the range of today's climates, and those are mostly in the tropics and subtropics. And that makes a lot of sense. If you're in a warming world, it's the parts of the world that are warmest today, the tropics and subtropics, that are sort of at the leading edge, and those are the ones that are first moving into a realm of climate space warmer than present conditions anywhere seen. And those climate projections for the tropics, which can be on the order of several degrees centigrade, are to reach those temperatures, you'd have to go back perhaps a million years or longer to find those kinds of equivalents.
And so from a environmental standpoint, or someone who's really concerned about plants and birds and all of that, as I am, what would that mean? I mean, there may be extinctions. You write about the possibility of extinctions. You say there are only three options for a species. Either it's going to go extinct, or it's going to lie low in situ, or it's going to migrate. And if the change of climate is so rapid, how can they migrate to stay alive in time?
Right. Well, what's one thing I think it's really important for people to realize is that in the 1980s and 1990s, and the focus is very much on climate mitigation, stopping climate change. Now the conversation is now two-track, where there's both the effort to slow down climate change and then also adaptation, which is this other question about, given that some amount of climate change is already happening, some amount of continued climate change is now inevitable, the question now just becomes how much climate change will we have and how much can we tolerate? So with adaptation, that is a focus on making both ecological systems and socioeconomic systems more resilient to climate change. And so when you get into questions about helping species adapt to climate change, there becomes the standard questions of preserving habitat for species, creating corridors for species. There's always, it's long understood in conservation ecology that creating connectedness among reserves is a good idea because it allows species to move and creates a greater total area for species to have available to them. Now, as climates change, those corridors become more essential. There's the idea of the Y2Y corridor. You may have heard that.
No, what's that?
Yosemite to Yukon corridor. Huh. We're creating a chain of reserves through the western U.S. and Canada to create a set of connectedness that species could migrate northwards as climate changes.
But the one thing you said that was alarming, there were some other alarming things, mm-hmm. Jack Williams, was that the standard conservation strategies may not be enough to preserve species and ecosystems.
Right. Well, this, as climate changes, this is opening up new tools or approaches that people previously would have not considered. Where now, for example, one of the ideas that comes up is the idea of assisted migration or managed relocation, where the idea may be that for some species, their current range or current distribution may not be suitable for them 100 years from now, under some of the higher end climate change scenarios. In that case, we may have to be ready to, if we want that species to survive, to be ready to move that species and relocate that species to another location. Now, some species have a high dispersal capability, high mobility ability. They can move themselves. But other species, we have to think about the possibility of being ready to sort of transplant and move those species.
For plants and trees.
For plants and trees and some lizards and salamanders. There's other animals that aren't good dispersers as well. But there's also a lot of concern and caution about that too, because we know from the record of ecological invasions that things can happen when a species is moved to a new environment And so there's a lot of caution about applying those sorts of approaches. And so right now, a lot of the conversation about balancing this risk, what is the risk that species will be driven to extinction or to sort of non-viable populations in some local locality versus the risk of and cost of moving species to another location?
And for, on the bird level, I mean, I think of the whooping crane, one of the most endangered species in North America, and it's... You know, the it's down there in Texas in the wintertime, and there could be huge floods, and they eat snails mostly. Maybe something would happen to the snails, and then what's going to happen to that population? I mean, the risk of extinction for the whooping crane is probably going to go up.
Right, and this is, I think when I approach this from the perspective of a paleoecologist, somebody who looks at past climate changes, and I think there's sort of two lessons from that. One is a hopeful lesson, which is that when we look at the last 20,000 years, the last several hundred thousand years, we see relatively few extinctions. Not many species go extinct, despite the fact we see these large swings in climate, these glacial interglacial cycles. And the fact that species have lived through these past ice ages and the ends of ice ages suggests that they have some ability to tolerate these kinds of climate changes. But of course, with a big caveat that we're heading into a new state of the system towards a warmer world than anything we've seen in a long time, perhaps with rates faster than anything we've seen, with a habitat that's much been heavily modified by human land use and land cover conversion. And so just because species have survived past climate changes doesn't necessarily mean they'll be able to survive this one. And so that's where, as stewards and managers of the ecosystem world around us, we need to be monitoring these populations, and we need to be, if we deem necessary, be ready to take steps to help these populations survive.
And what do you make of the idea that there's a tipping point beyond which, you know, things are just going to go to hell in a handbasket, and the Earth is going to be essentially unlivable? That's kind of the catastrophic view of global warming.
Those sorts of tipping points, I think the risk of them is real, and the probability is hard to assess. And I think that's one of the great challenges. And I think one of the books I was very influenced by a few years ago was the Black Swan by Taleb, talking about when you're working with complex systems are prone to rare but extreme behavior. And he was talking specifically about the stock market and the economic system, but the same basic lesson applies to the global climate system as well. I think it is something we need to be cautious about and cognizant of, that as we push the climate system with higher and higher levels of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, the risk of passing a tipping point increases. There's a lot of work right now. People at UW-Mass are among some of the leaders in this. Steve Carpenter is one of the global leaders in this work in looking for early warning signals. How do you identify or see the precursors to a tipping point before you reach it?
What would be an early warning sign?
Well, it's at a global scale, let's start with Steve's work. Steve's work, he's worked with these lakes in which they've steadily added nutrients to a lake. They add more and more nutrients to the lake, and at some point it flips from a non-eutrophied state to a eutrophied state, and that switch can happen very quickly. So they've been looking for these indicators of how, are there some organisms changing, or there's some patterns in the variation in these records. There's some statistical tests you can do, look for the autocorrelation in these time series, that may be some statistical indicators of when a system is moving towards a tipping point or an inflection point.
I mean, one reason I'm a little worried here is because the predictions from the 2007 UN climate group, those predictions have been conservative, given what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years. I'm thinking of the Arctic, melting the Arctic Ocean, the Greenland ice shelf, and things like that. Those are surpassing even the pessimistic predictions in some of those earlier reports. So that lends credence, at least my lay mind, that maybe we are heading toward this tipping point.
You know, as a scientist, you want to, I think the best way to express is that the possibility of a tipping point is real, and if a tipping point was passed, that would be a problem. That would be a concern. But the challenge for us right now is to know where those tipping points are, how soon we're going to reach them, and that's one of the big fundamental scientific challenges for us.
And there's a real differential depending on where you live. I'm speaking with Jack Williams here, my guest, who's a professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, because here we are in Wisconsin. Wisconsin you know, for those of us who ain't the really cold winter here, Wisconsin would be a more hospitable place to live. And you've done some predictions where, you know, the weather may be more like Kansas or Oklahoma by the year 2100. But for people who are on the sea, you know, they may be underwater. For people who are living on islands, they may be underwater. For people, as you were saying, in the tropics, things may get drastically worse. And so it's hard for people, I think, in the upper Midwest who aren't necessarily suffering or see the suffering. You know, we didn't get hit by Hurricane Sandy here, to realize what may be going on. And so how do you educate people when their eyes aren't really seeing it? Or maybe we're feeling it because it was so warm in February, but that was a nice feeling.
Right. Well, I think when you think about climate change, I think one of the first things you have to do is do these vulnerability assessments and these risk assessments. And that's the first step in this process, is figure out which are the areas that are most susceptible to climate change, and then how do you make those areas more resilient and less susceptible to climate change. That's just sort of a practical, common sense thing to do. And when you look around the U.S., it depends on where you are. If you're in Florida, sea level rise and hurricane intensity is a thing to be paying attention to, and a 3-foot sea level rise, which is sort of the standard projection for the end of this century, with some uncertainty around that, could go higher, maybe up to 6 feet. That would be a loss of land area, and that an increased susceptibility to hurricanes.
A huge amount of Florida might be underwater, or risk of being underwater.
Right. I don't have the aerial conversion number, but because the relief is so low there, that a 3-foot vertical rise translates into many feet horizontal sea level loss, or land loss to sea level rise. If you're in the American Southwest, water availability is a big concern, and the models very consistently suggest or predict that the American Southwest will get drier over this century and have less water available to it.
Even drier than it is now.
Even drier than it is today, and both through the and with sort of the double whammy of rising temperatures and less precipitation on an average annual basis. Some years, of course, will be higher or lower, but over the next century, the trend would be towards less rainfall and less water availability. Here in the upper Midwest, I think the things that people are paying, when I talk to people in this area, that people are paying attention to are the North Woods, the North Woods of Wisconsin. Those species are, most of them are at their southern range limits. You think about, again, black spruce and white spruce and jack pine and so forth. Those species are expected to, you know, we say migrate northwards with climate change, but what that means in practice is that southern populations would, you know, fail to reproduce or die. Northern populations would colonize into new areas. And so one scenario would be a reduction in the area and extent of the Wisconsin North Woods over the century under some of these climate change scenarios.
And then the whole economy that's based on ice fishing and snowmobiling and all
tourism
that.
And recreation. Yeah. Those are the kinds of things that you have to start planning for. And you don't, you know, you have to walk a tight line. You don't want to be alarmist about things. You want to say this is where the range of outcomes are over the century. And adaptation planning means taking these scenarios into account, starting to plan around these scenarios. You know, you hope for the best and plan for the worst with this kind of work.
And then what about invasive species, illnesses, things like that?
Right. That varies a bit of where you are. And many species, I'm thinking malaria and other pathogens, have mosquitoes as their vectors. The range of mosquito is temperature sensitive. And so some species, some pathogens that are carried by mosquitoes, such as malaria, are expected to expand their distribution into areas that they're not today. That's less of a concern in the U.S. because we have a very good public health system and access to healthcare and so forth. But in other parts of the world, that's a bigger concern.
You know, one thing, Jack Williams, that I noticed when I was reading some of your work, again, I hadn't thought of, it's kind of in the realm of science fiction in my head anyway, but you have this idea that new species will arise. And tell me about that.
Right, well, it's not so much new species per se, although one of the really active areas of research right now is this field of rapid evolution. How quickly can species evolve when confronted with novel environments? And a lot of the work there has been done with looking at invasive species. If you transplant a species from one place to another, that species, you know, inadvertently or otherwise, that species is now encountering other species that it hadn't seen before. And there's been a lot of work done showing these species can have quite rapid rates of both phenotypic, you know, physical adaptation, then genotypic, genetic adaptation.
So then you'd have the mutations, the Darwinian mutations, and,
right,
and the
right.
evolution cycle sped up real quick.
That's right. And then in addition to sort of new species evolving or existing species evolving, there's also this reshuffling of species where, you know, in ecology, it's not just individual species that you think about. It's the interactions among species. You were talking about the whooping cranes and their food resources before. And that is, I think, again, one of the other big lessons of the last ice age and looking at past glacial-glacial cycles is that when we've seen these past climate changes, what we see very clearly is this reshuffling of species into novel mixtures and novel associations. So we sort of, from our present-day perspective, is sort of take for granted that the forests we see around us, these ecological webs we see around us, are sort of fixed and unchanging. But you look in the geological past, not that long ago, and you see these reshufflings of species and mixtures quite different from today.
And that can happen abruptly, you've been saying in your study.
And that can happen abruptly. And it can happen abruptly in two different ways. It can happen if you have an abrupt climate change. There's an event known as the Younger Dryas, and which was, you had this very rapid warming, and maybe it's, you know, 5 degrees to 10 degrees in some of the areas within a few decades during sort of the coming out of the last ice age, a sort of abrupt stair-step warming event. You see very rapid changes in plant community composition, that these plant communities, some species are becoming quickly much more abundant and expanding across the landscape. Other species become much less abundant on a, you know, on a very short, again, within a few decades of centuries, of very short time scales. The other kind of abrupt response you see in the past is more where we get back to before about these sort of, maybe something more like a tipping point, or where you see maybe it's a single drought, maybe it's some tipping point is past, where the exact mechanism we're still working through. But what we see, for example, about 5,000 years ago is the widespread collapse of eastern hemlock, a tree species that's very widespread today, was very widespread then. Within a span of a few centuries, it became, it went from being a dominant tree taxon across the Great Lakes to New England to still being there, but with a major population crash. And that it stayed low for about for several thousand years. And so an example of abrupt change, probably due to drought and climate variability.
Jack Williams, it sounds like there's a race between, you know, the adaptability or Darwinian mutation ability of plants and animals and birds and what we're doing to the environment. And that's kind of where we're at right now, and it's unclear who's going to win that race.
And, you know, evolution has always been a race, right? You know, species are always having to adapt to, you know, to the evolutionary arms race, to the changing world around them. In some sense, this is nothing new under the sun. But in another sense, we are, by taking carbon dioxide levels from 280 ppm to perhaps 700 ppm by the end of this century, we're subjecting them to a level of carbon dioxide that they have not seen. You have to go back maybe 20 million years ago. Now, to be clear, CO2 is itself not harmful to organisms, but the climate changes that that would then result from higher CO2 levels can have effects on species.
And if there is one thing that we could do on a policy level, what would that be?
That's a great question. I'm a scientist, not a policy expert, of course. That's the big caveat up front. But I think the clear issue in front of us is that putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere creates these, what, you know, an economist would call externalities, right? There's these costs associated with that. There's risks, whether it's rising sea level or other drought in the Western U.S. And who bears those costs? Right now, it's the general public that bears those costs. And how do you create a mechanism that the costs are paid by those who generate that activity?
That's wise advice, and I thank you for being my guest today. Jack Williams has been my guest here on Progressive Radio. He is a professor of climate, people, and the environment at the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You've been listening to me, Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive here on Progressive Radio. Jack Williams, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.